What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 94, Identification and Management of Sports Hernias, featuring Rihal Bajani. The interview is conducted by Dr. Josh Yellen from the Masters of Athletic Training Program at U of H. I, of course, am Jeremy Jackson, the host, the head guy here at the Sports Medicine Broadcast, but most of the work done here at the 13th Annual Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Update was done by my colleagues, Dr. Mark Knobloch, Dr. Josh Yellen, and Bill Hell. They did most of the interviews and those kind of things. So the first part of this is the lecture from Dr. Bajani that he gave to the Mass, and then the second part is the interview with Dr. Yellen. And so Dr. Bajani had actually jumped in earlier before his talk, and so some of the intro may be missed there, and this talk, he may reference some of that. So if you look back at the episode with Dr. Samarad, episode 92, then you may catch the beginning of that too there. So again, for the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, I am Jeremy Jackson. We're definitely looking for ways to interact with you, so use Twitter, hashtag BSMB during live shows, or other times, at PHS Sports Med. Again, Sports Medicine Broadcast has my email, my phone number, all that stuff, ways to get a hold of me. Tell us what you want to hear. We'll get that person on. If there's somebody that you want to hear from, give us their information, and we will contact them and do our best to get them on. So, again, thank you. We're here to entertain, educate, and serve you, the athletic training and sports and medicine population. So whatever we can do to make this show better, please let me know. Also, rate it in iTunes whenever you can, whenever you get a chance to find it. Rate it so it'll help other people. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com.
Good afternoon, guys. Don't listen to anything Kel says. Cooks, and one of the only times we get a chance to harass me, so I let him have it. I will wait for my talk to come up. Once my talk's up, we'll go ahead and start. Thank you guys for coming out. I know this is a long, long day for you guys. I know you guys have another day plus, so we're trying to make it deep, concise, and to the point. Sports Hernias.
You showing them up?
It's a relatively new phenomenon that we've been trying to figure out over the last decade or so. Really hard to diagnose, really hard to manage, and that's going to be, I could walk off the stage right now and get away with that because that's exactly what it is. But I'm going to kind of go through this a little bit. We're going to go through the definition, the anatomy, and all the fun stuff, but I'm going to kind of skim through this a little bit. What is a sports hernia? So I have here two different ways I've written out what a sports hernia is. And there's in the literature about five more ways that this can happen, but there's some genetic principles that kind of make sense based on all the evidence. Essentially, it's a weakness in the posterior inguinal wall. That's what it is. It causes a variation of multiple things. It can cause your transversalis fascial muscle to dilate, which can cause the inguinal triangle to widen and cause issues with stabilization of the tendons and muscles around that area. That itself is the usual route of cause for the hernia, but the pain actually comes from the irritation of the genital femoral nerve that is right along its same pathway. Commonly bilateral, I use that word very loosely because it's commonly bilateral, but might not be commonly asymptomatic. So you see one, you diagnose on one side, chances are there's probably one on the other side that's also playing a role. Males obviously get it more than females. Kicking and twisting sports such as football, soccer, and hockey cause it. And like I said, there are other ways that can cause it, but I wanted to go down this path because this is the most common path in which the sports hernia is thrown out. Alright, the next four slides are going to look extremely busy, and I know there are many slides, but I'm going to do my best to kind of go through them because the anatomy in this area is very complicated. In med school, when you do cadaver lab, this is the area that most people dread to go through, and I know that if you guys have done cadaver lab, you'll be like, oh wow, this is the pelvic floor. It looks like it's a big jungle mess. But when you go through it, you got the big muscle phalanx, the rectus abdominis coming across here, the transversalis fascia, the external oblique, the inguinal ligaments coming down. Like I said, you've got all these different muscles, but if you look carefully, here's that deep inguinal ring, here's the fibrillaris coming down, and the area of the sports hernia is right about there. It's slightly narrow to the pubic symphysis, pretty much near the ASIS, a little bit inferior to the ASIS. If you look at the next slide here, this is exactly where you have the tear. You got to remember there's seven layers that go from the skin to the peritoneum. So we're talking one layer of muscle amongst all of these. which leads to the posting to the wall incompetency. Another picture, kind of showing the same exact thing. This is just the shame mechanism for what can happen or what can compensate. Looking at it from a cephalic cornet, the exact shearing force that causes that muscle to tear, and you can see how it can go across. Once again, the point of these slides is to give you guys an anatomy of it, because I'm going to say it's a little bit more complicated than that. So, what you guys need to look out for, this is where the key buzz points come in. Usually unilateral or bilateral groin pain, only worsened by exercise, even after a rest phase. Usually starts slow, starts as a nagging pain, might be diagnosed as abdominal strain or rectus strain, or even sometimes they get missed as a groin strain. It might really lead down to the perineum, to the testicles, to the adductors, to the upper thigh. It usually starts in a very typical pattern. It starts when you exercise, and it's at the end of the activity when it first starts, and as the symptoms get worse, it starts making its way up to the beginning of the activity. Some movements can cause it to worsen. The typical coughing, sneezing, Valsalva kind of stuff may or may not happen. Some sources in the literature point to it does. I have yet to see one that actually does do that particular thing. The pain will go away if you rest them, but as soon as you try to work them out again, it comes right back. That's one of your red flags that goes up and says, hey, you know what, there's something else going on here. We tried the physical therapy, you tried the ice, you tried the anti-inflammatories, nothing works. This is your second red flag, because now you kind of said, I've done everything I need to do, and I can't figure out why. The biggest thing you're going to remember is the last point. You cannot feel a sports hernia clinically, okay? So I'm going to say that again, you cannot feel the hernia. So if you feel the massive holes in the testicle, you're doing a hernia check, and you feel it, that is more than likely not a sports hernia. So don't, if you think we're anything from the slides, those are three or four bullet points I want you guys to take away. The physical exam. So obviously the person that wrote that said rule out the testicular mass and the classic hernia. Just do that hernia check and make sure you have it. Just remember that if you when you do the hernia check, you're checking for the inguinal hernia as well as the femoral hernia. Examine everything around the area, the adductors, the iliopsoas, the abdominal muscles. Look for stretching, flexibility, as well as strength. Always examine the unexpected side first. So I'm going to rephrase that word from unaffected to the asymptomatic side, which I previously stated that this is probably a bilateral issue. The way you can actually test to see if this actually works, if you have a patient asupine, put the hip in my flexion and you externally rotate like you would do the whole Patrick Stable test. You don't go all the way. And you can actually insert the your pinky fingers through the scrotum and the external connection. And what you might feel is enlargement of the ring. That is a very subjective term. That's the only test in the literature that can show to actually have any kind of major sports hernia. I would say you might will reproduce the pain that comes from the hernia with this test. Tenderness on the conjoined tendon or pubic cubicle may or may not be hard to kind of elicit, especially in your heavier athletes, especially your football athletes, so kind of working in that area. Pain resistant knee reduction may act like a groin strain, but we've already ruled that out because we've already done the whole tissue rule out and kind of got the red flag. And pain with resistant sit-ups. You're going to be testing the muscles from above and below the pelvis. Alright, differential diagnosis. Lots here, okay, so left column, left row, essentially we talked about the classic hernia, the right side talked about all the other big stuff. Groin injuries, you know, there's this spectrum, and I use it, that word loosely, between athletic pubalgia, sports hernias, and osteitis pubis. So there's a lot of things that can cause this. So the list is there for you guys to know, only because it is an exhaustive list. I don't expect anyone to memorize this. I don't expect anyone to remember half the stuff on this list. But just remember, sports hernia is not the one thing you're jumping after. More likely, you rule out versus the rule in. Always get x-rays first. This is where you know, in central position, they're going to get x-rays. The things you're looking for x-rays is to rule out other causes. You're looking for osteitis pubis. You're looking for hip arthritis. You're looking for bone tumors. You're looking for anything that tells you this is not sports hernia. The old studies used to do bone scans, but you can still do them, What you're looking for is stress fracture, once again, osteoarthritis, inflammation around that area, and pain osteo lesions. Nowadays, our people can get them. We've got more advanced imaging, which I'm going to get to here in a second. CT scans, if you expect a bone metal pathology or past hernia, CT tells us are much more better for diagnosing past hernia. Now, if I give the talk next year, I would probably say that the MRI is better than CT, because I don't know, imaging has got a lot of stuff. But I like that. Ultrasound. This is a unique one. So in the South, not terribly big on muscle cell ultrasound, but in the North, Midwest, and the North East Coast, dynamic ultrasound is the way to go for these four hernias. I'm going to show you guys some pictures here in a few minutes. You will see the bulge happen. This is your best methodology to determine if you have a sports hernia, because it just shows up like wow, it's in your face. You're going to see that here. MRIs are becoming much more useful. Like I said, you're going to see this increased signal, you're going to see some attenuation and some asymmetry between the abdominal wall muscles. You're going to see fluid within the muscles. Once again, this is a static study, so the ultrasound reproducing the pain in that particular motion, which usually was just a sit-up, and seeing it on ultrasound is probably going to be the way to go, but once again, we're in the South and not the North anymore. Herniographies, old method, basically you take a bit of dye and you inject it directly into the peritoneum, directly into the abdomen, and you watch the dye leak out. It's like doing an arthrogram, except you're doing it with fairly very painful, very low yield, but it was being done in the past. So I'm going to ask Jeremy to kind of click on the left box over there for me, if you guys don't mind. Can you guys do that together to the video? That possible? Yeah. This is the posterior inguinal wall. If you give it a second to load up, I'm going to kind of describe it. If it shows, let me show. Hello? No? There's a video there.
So you say. No.
Oh, lovely. Go with the right side. Let's see the right side.
You not linked your video.
Oh,
no, he's a doctor.
Oh! Okay, so what the video is supposed to show, and I'll see if I can get guys. Nope, that's a new slide. Alright, so what was the video supposed to show is you're supposed to see the inguinal wall on the left side. You can see this nice little fascial layer come across, and basically you see as the patient did a sit up, that the wall kind of moved in a very symmetrical fashion. It just kind of went down and went up. And on the film on the right, basically saw the big bulge pop out, clearly along close to the inguinal wall. Gave away the answer. This study was found on the internet. I think there's a handful of people in the country that have as prominent one of the things. I'll try to get you guys these videos. Applies to the load up, but that's okay. Let's skip to the next one. So we're going to skip past the ultrasound. MRIs. All right, this MRI slide is extremely busy. Extremely busy. But I'm going to kind of point to the different areas. Each of the color boxes corresponds to the section coming across. They labeled the groin tendon right about there. I could not find a really good fit, which I've had a handful of these come in, but none of them were clear as day. So what I'm going to point to is usually in this slide here or this slide here, you'll see whitish fluid, which basically is type of accuracy, which will tell you that there is some pathology there. Once again, more for show for you guys, the proof of point that this is a very hard thing to diagnose. There's your passive increased signal. So you have your adductor cubicle, you have fluid along where the muscles attach. This is a common cone. I don't think this is that right on this image, but I think if you approach it might be a little better. That's one way to find it. Okay. For you guys, non-operative treatment, less than 20% success rate. You work on protecting the core, strengthening the back, and actually working on the flexibility. Try the NSAIDs, try to eat, try to prolong rest. There is some new data came out this year, maybe in PRP in this area, it's mixed. There's no two studies showing it. However, I just thought out there because we might see this come out in the next couple of years. Basically, the instrument fixes both of them, so then you can fix it. 63 to 90% success rate, depending on the surgeon. There's only a handful of guys in the country that do this on a regular basis. There's try out one or two guys in the city that I know of that do this on a semi-regular basis enough for me to trust them to fix it. It depends on where they got trained, if it's open versus laparoscopic, and all you need is to pay the actual lesion. And you may end up severing the genitalmeninal nerve or that femoral nerve just to get rid of the pain that did it. The key for you guys is going to be the rehab piece. There are no protocols at all in the literature that will kind of go through the post-operative recovery from foot hernia. There are principles in place. Usually it takes 6 to 8 weeks for return, and closer to 12 weeks if you are conservative. I prefer the 12-week approach. These things can become a nuisance. Most sports, professional athletes will take anywhere from 8 to 10 weeks, but you will notice that they probably won't be brought back any earlier than that. Once they're working on the same, the pelvic flexibility, the strengthening and stability, you work on isometrics first, the day after surgery, start walking by the first week, jogging within the first 2 weeks, sprinting by 3 weeks in a straight line only, and then do specific exercises 6 to 8 weeks. If you guys want to Google, I think there is a protocol out on the internet that was done by physical therapists. Once again, did not like it. I thought it was a little conservative. It was about 14 to 16 weeks, but I think 12 weeks is a good length and number for it. So, going through the treatment algorithm, essentially, what we talked about. You're not going to catch it early. Average time of diagnosis is 2 to 3 months. Usually you treat for the pathology that you think it is, groin strain, abdominal strain. You do conservative modalities, rest, ice, NSAIDs, and do some strengthening, flexibility, pelvis. Does it get better? Does it in fact worsen when you get the back out to activity? Red flags go up. That can start getting into a position. We'll make sure we rule out classical hernia and secondary causes for the same type of pain. We'll get them properly imaged, and then once you get them imaged, you can try once again to work on flexibility and strengthening. If the patient chooses, more often than not, they'll get this surgically fixed. 10 or 12 weeks later, get them back out there. Once again, the key point is if they get one side fixed, be completely aware they can walk and not these things. Both bilaterally, so there's a decent chance that the other side may be affected and may not be healing again. So it's important to recognize that in case they come back 6 months a year later and say, hey doc, I think I might have the same thing on the other side. Don't blow them off. It might be more of a quicker get them back to the doctor and sit and stand to make sure that there's a thing out. Those are my references. I will leave the floor open for questions. So the question was, if I'm hearing it right, because I got a big bang going in my head, is how long does it take for the non-operative phase to kind of, you know, push them through before you say that's it? You know what I mean? Literature is sparse. I've had people go 6 weeks. I've had people go 12 weeks. I would probably leave it at a 6 week number. I don't think if you have better 6 weeks, it's not going to get better. And like I said, you're mainly working on flexibility and strengthening. You're not working on anything else. If you can't get them to heal up, it's not going to heal. This is an injury that does not tend to heal itself. The goal is to make them stay symptomatic and get back out there. So you're not feeling anything. You're just trying to make them feel better so they can get back to doing things they want to do. So pain is the biggest dictator of that particular protocol. Other questions? Okay. Either you guys all speak, you guys are tired and want to hear. I guess it's Dr. Beckman after me?
No.
Alright. Well, thank you guys once again for coming out here.
Alright, we're back here at the Sports Medicine Broadcast at the Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute, UT Physicians Sports Medicine Update 2014. Again, I'm Dr. Josh Elling with the University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. And to my right, we have Dr. Rahul Bijani set up second part of his interview. Dr. Johnny, thanks again for being with us.
Oh, you guys are most welcome.
So let's talk a little bit about, we talked about your training as a physician. We got into it just a little bit before Dr. Ott showed up, so let's go back to that.
Absolutely.
All right, so you went through medical school, and then you do a three-year residency
in family medicine.
And then how did you decide that you want to do a fellowship?
So it's actually kind of peculiar. I had decided I wanted to do a fellowship before I even started residency. Quite interesting story. I did all my undergrad and medical school research in heart and vascular surgery, published about 30 papers, worked all the way through, thought I was going to do the whole shebang-a-bang, got accepted.
I'm sorry, shebang-a-bang?
Yeah, shebang-a-bang is a medical term for those who are paying attention. Shebang-a-bang is a medical
term. I understand. Yeah. It's one of those rare diseases like anorexia.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
But, you know, kind of fourth year came around. I was on fall rotation, getting ready to do interviews for residency, and I did my first rotation with a primary care sports medicine doc. That'd be cool, you know, get to see what's out there, get to go some fine night lights, football junkie like myself. And 4 weeks later, I was like, okay, now I'm going to have to rewrite my personal statement. I'm going to have to redo my application. My dean was pretty upset with me. My mentor slash boss who added all the papers was really upset at me, but it was just one of those things. I knew I wanted to do it. I came into residency as an intern knowing I wanted to go into sports medicine fellowship.
And so let's talk just briefly, you know, some of our listeners learned earlier that, again, we have some listeners that are younger, maybe an undergraduate. We have some listeners that are professionals. So it's a broad age range. And just to keep everything on an even track, everybody goes through the same 4 years of medical school.
Correct.
And when people think about sports medicine, they think about the orthopedic side, and that's a five-year residency.
Five plus, yeah, plus the fellowship.
So that's a six-year, right? Six specialist. Tell us more about family medicine. What's the residency usually about?
It's usually 3 years. There are a couple of programs across the country that do what's called the P4 project, which is a four-year residency, which incorporates a year of research. 3 years is pretty typical. You get a wide range of experience in all the different subspecialties as well as the general practice. You basically get a grasp on everything from the time you're born to the time you're passing away, which gives someone in sports medicine a unique advantage because you get, you know, the level of athletes you take care of can be anywhere from middle school to high school to college, professional to even, you know, we can call the elderly in their own athletic class, which has its own subset of injuries. So mm-hmm. It gives you that wide range.
And then after that, you do a year of fellowship.
You can do 1 to 2 years of fellowship, depending if you want to do research or no research. Like I said, there are about 106 this year fellowships in the country. We have two here in Houston right now, and there's it's a difficult field to get into. It's been getting, like I said, being very, very hot now. I think this year there were close to 700 applicants for 140 spots.
Really? Across the country?
Across the country. And so it is a very competitive field because everyone realizes that it's the next new thing in medicine to be.
And so there are a couple different ways you can get to, you know, if you're not going to be a surgeon, there are a couple different ways to get that sports medicine fellowship. So talk to me a little bit about the difference in your training as family medicine. And, you know, tell me the difference, right? Because you hear these terms that are pretty interchangeable. I'm family medicine, you know, or I'm general practice.
Right.
What's the difference?
There isn't really a difference. It's, you know, you can use the word general practice for an internist, which is an internal medicine training, which is 3 years focused on adults. You can use the term general practice for family medicine. So there are... you alluded to another question, which I do want to address, is, you know, how many different ways can you get into a non-orthopedic-based sports medicine fellowship? You can go through a three-year residency in family medicine. You can do a three-year residency in internal medicine. You can do the three-year residency in pediatrics and go that route. You can do a three-year residency in emergency medicine and go that route. You could go three-year residency in physical medicine rehabilitation. So there are four or five different ways you can actually get to the non-orthopedic, what we call the primary care sports medicine fellowship. Mm-hmm. Each different residency kind of dictates what you do when you come out. It's pretty fascinating. So the guys that do the PM&R, the physical medicine rehabilitation, do a lot of spine injections and do a lot of rehab work. Guys that do the emergency medicine sports medicine route will tend to end up more in the acute high events, the marathons, the silence for mm-hmm. NFL games, because they're more trained in all the acute stuff and they're much more useful in those
airway management,
exactly. Pediatrics, sports medicine is a very unique field in itself because they really only deal with up to the age of 18.
Right.
But
junior high, high school athletes.
Exactly. And so they are actually more trained in child development and injuries that result as a development. A lot of fracture care comes in role. So this is where, you know, we don't have enough pediatric orthopedics across the country, but we do have pediatric sports medicine docs that can manage fractures not operatively for those that are clinically indicated.
Right.
And it's become a huge field for those. Internal medicine, sports medicine is a relatively rare combination, but it does happen. Used more in the adult setting, can be used for a wide variety of different adult problems, as well as, you know, the elderly with training exercises, as well as, you know, the fit model for using exercise programs for chronic diseases like diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and whatnot. So there is a difference on which route you take. So for those, you know, kids that are in undergrad that are thinking about getting in, you know, and even those in med school, kind of have to predetermine that just a little bit. Hard to do, but if you're really gun-ho about doing sports medicine, you kind of want to know which route it seems
best how to get there and why you want to be there. So we're talking to Dr. Rahul Bajani, who is our co-medical director, along with Dr. Jim Muntz for the Master of Athletic Training Program, and founded at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. So really unique interaction that we have, and, you know, I send out some emails, and I'm looking for a medical director to satisfy our CADE, the Commission on Accreditation for Athletic Training Education Standards, and I come across your name through a common friend we have, Kevin Bastien, who's now head athletic trainer, I believe, over at the Detroit Lions.
Yep, we're at training. Kind of ironic how that works out.
I'm happy for Kevin. I think he's doing really well. And Kevin, if somehow you're listening to this, congratulations, and we miss you.
Yeah, I agree. Kevin was a huge influence. I think he was the one that brought us together. It was an interesting story. We were doing Sugar Land Middle School physicals, and after physicals were done, you know, Kevin is a very simple, no-nonsense kind of guy. Because, you know, and when he comes up, he says, "Doc, I got to talk to you." My radar goes from, okay, I'm just hanging out, to, okay, what's going on? It pulls me aside, tells me about Josh, tells me about U of H, and says, hey, this is a very unique opportunity. And I said, you know what? Kevin, I trust you. You want me there, I will interview, and I'll do what I need to do to get there.
And so you and I have a conversation, and we talk about the different roles of the medical director, and we talk about what you'll be doing. And so you have a really unique position with us in that you're going to be serving as co-medical director, again, with Dr. Jim Muntz. You're also going to be teaching a general medical course for us.
Correct. And so I will be teaching the Summer 2 course, General Comorbid Conditions in Sports, which I'm going to use as a dual-purpose class. One, obviously, to get the accreditation and get the students ready for athletic training from a general medical condition standpoint. But two, also to show them chicks and pearls for things that they will see out in the field. You know, athletic trainers are very underappreciated field in general, and you guys deal with much more than just the orthopedic stuff. I mean, you see it every day. I interact with my head trainer, Max Mahaffey, at Sugar Land Skeeters, and more often than not, I'm walking into a training room dealing with a medical condition, not an orthopedic condition. It's important for our students to know what to do, how to handle certain things without having to get the physician involved.
And so from a physician standpoint, you know, I was taught to, you know, I know how to use an otoscope and an ophthalmoscope. I know how to look in somebody's ear and say that's not normal. I know how to look in somebody's retina and know that's not normal. Or I know how to take a blood pressure and, you know, evaluate the pulse and know that that's not normal. And I know how to auscultate lungs and know that, okay, I know this sounds like Darth Vader, that's not normal, and this one that sounds normal. Tell us some other things that you think from a family practice side, sports medicine fellowship trained. What are some other things that you think athletic trainers need to know from a general medical standpoint?
So I would take what you just described, and I want to take our students to the next step. You know, what you described as phase one, being able to do common physical exam and be able to try to say what's normal and abnormal, you got to take it one step further. You got to be able to say to a certain extent, hey, you know what, this heart does not sound normal, but what specifically does not make it sound normal? In sports medicine, as vast of a knowledge base that it has, is very discrete patterns that will basically say normal versus not normal. More importantly, normal, not normal versus, okay, you know what, this is something that we can manage. The classic example.
What's an uh-oh not normal?
So the classic example I gave is when we do physicals, which is the heart murmur. You know, the abnormal heart sound that everyone has been so freaking out about in high school physicals and college physicals. So there's very specific symptoms and very specific things that murmurs can do that will make you say, uh-oh. The things, most often than not, murmurs are abnormal, but they're not, okay, we need to get this checked out tomorrow, abnormal. Mm-hmm. So that's where I want to help take the next step and say, you know what skill set, what questions do I need to be asking to make me believe that is this particular finding, physical exam finding, abnormal, relevant or something that we can just wait on?
Because that's really something that you're going to be looking at on a pre-participation examination, right? And if you don't have the fortune and ability to be in a city like ours or a university like ours where we have access to some of the best medical care in the country, and you're an athletic trainer in a small town anywhere in the country, you're going to need to know the skill set so that you know when to refer, what not to refer, who to refer to, etc.
And I think that the last part's the key is, you know, who to refer to and how quickly you need to get your call done. You know, sometimes athletic trainers are going to be, you know, as smart, if not smarter, than their general practice docs that they're going to be referring to because of the fact that this is a very specific field. And unlike general practice where everything is, you know, has to be worked out, sports medicine, you have to figure out if this kid needs to be worked up or this athlete needs to be worked up. And more importantly, is this workup going to prohibit them from playing sports? So there's a very focused algorithm for which you need to go down the pattern, which is why I think that athletic trainers, AR first line, and that's always been a big principle of mine. I got trained in Detroit where athletic trainers were our eyes and ears, and you trust them implicitly as long as you have confidence in them, and you teach them, and have a symbiotic relationship, because that becomes very, very important to how the whole medical team works.
So you brought up a couple different things here about, you know, some of the areas that athletic trainer may be lacking in what you're going to teach them. And you and I have discussed a few things about some of the things that you can learn from athletic trainers. What are some of the things that you think you can learn from athletic trainers?
So athletic trainers are, like I said, my eyes and ears. I will use my example once again with the baseball team, the Skeeters, and Max Mahaffey. He and I interact every day. But he is the gatekeeper for me. As much as I am the gatekeeper for the next step up, he's the gatekeeper for me. He has full interaction with all the athletes. He knows the psychological component to these athletes. I mean, I put my eyes on them for 5-10 minutes. I can get certain finite information. But it's the trainers that know the kids, that know the situation, that know what's going on. In addition, it's their ability to remember injury histories. One thing that's extremely important for athletic trainers is that they can pretty much tell you on the bat which athlete has which injury and how bad the injuries have been, previous history and whatnot. It makes life for me as a person a lot easier. So when I come into the room, I can come in there and do the whole exam blind, but I actually will ask my trainer first, what is going on? Give me some relevance. Give me some psychological components. So when I go examine, my mind is already 10 steps ahead of where it would be if I just walked in the room completely blind.
What are some other things? You know, we talked about in medical school, you know, I've had some conversations with some other fellows and physicians, and, you know, boy, in medical school, you learn a lot about disease, but you don't learn a whole lot about health. Right. You don't know a whole lot about prevention, you know.
Primary prevention is a key word.
That's right.
Yeah.
Prevention trainers, and health promotion.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge component. I mean, you see, we have athletic trainers in our Memorial Healthcare System that are out there promoting wellness in ways that I would never even know. A lot of my personal workout regimen has been basically done by athletic trainers that have taught me how to work out in a way that makes me more efficient in what I need to do.
Right.
Diet. You'd be surprised how much that athletic trainers have educated me on just simple dietary principles, electrolytes, hydration patterns, things that you can learn in med school, learn in fellowship, but may not be fully able to implement unless you have someone that's doing it every single day to show you how to do it.
So it's probably similar to some of the skills that we have in terms of rehab, in terms of modalities, in terms of return to play. It's a lot like, hey, look, you're doing this every day. Similar to what you just brought up about being able to, you know, listen to a heart, understand, okay, this is a murmur I need to refer to a cardiologist, or this is a murmur that I've I'm fairly confident that it's a benign situation that we're just going to watch.
Correct. And so the rehab, you know, the rehab situation, it's huge. It really is. I don't fully think everyone realizes how important an athletic trainer is to the rehabilitation of an athlete. Every day I walk in and watch my trainers work on athletes doing the programs and everything. It's almost like the doctor walks in and says, okay, you know what? You guys are doing exactly what you're supposed to do. Good. Kudos. But it's, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like, wow, this is, you know, here's a throwing program that I don't even know about. Oh, wait, there's this mortality that might do this and this. And, you know, if it's evidence based, it's amazing that what you will learn. Every trainer is slightly different in their regimen, but it's just understanding the biomechanics that you guys have learned as far as rehab makes you guys much more valuable than me. I'm more of a diagnostician and trying to get things rolling for you guys. But you guys run the show. It's always going to be your training. It always has been.
So what are some of the things that you think are going to be needed? You know, it's a really unique position that we have here at the University of Houston, developing this new Master of Athletic Training program. Again, you can find that at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. And as we're developing this program, you know, I'm constantly thinking, God, what can I do to enhance the student's ability? What can I do to enhance the clinician's ability to be a better clinician, a better healthcare provider? What are some of the things that when you look, what can athletic training do as a profession to make themselves a more valuable commodity?
Well, that's, you know, coming out of the training room, I think, you know, there's a piece of the puzzle that most people haven't started realizing is that whole quote-unquote physician extender role that, you know, has become a big issue in medicine in this country. You know, everyone's thinking of PAs and nurse practitioners coming in. I do see a role, a huge role, because athletic trainers in the clinic.
So let's harp on that for a second. Physician extender versus physician assistant in your office. It sounds like there's probably two different roles. Physician assistant is really on your family practice side.
Correct.
Whereas physician extender is really on your sports medicine side.
Correct. So there's a couple. I do have a physician assistant. She's wonderful. She does help get me moving and get me through some of the clinic day, and she does take care of a lot of my family medicine stuff. But, you know, a physician extender, and a leg trainer is a perfect example of a person that can take this role, is someone to get in before me, screen out the athletes, get the necessary evaluation done, and more importantly, once the diagnosis has been made, verified by myself, start getting the rehab piece going. You know, this is, you know, the comprehensive care that we so want is that most people go to the doctor's office, oh, you have this diagnosis, here you go, walk out the door. This is where you can actually bring in this whole big multidisciplinary approach and say, here's, we actually have an athletic trainer in the office here. Let's get them to show you some rehab exercises. Let's get them to start figuring out how we want to progress you. So you're not lost when you leave this office. You actually know exactly day by day, week by week, what your game plan is when you walk out the door. And I think it's a much higher patient satisfaction for them to know that they actually have been coached on what they need to do.
Yeah, there's some really interesting data out there right now about athletic trainers, physician extenders, and being able to increase productivity of the office, and obviously increased productivity leads to increased generation of funds.
Correct.
Increased generation of funds, obviously more money, everybody's happy.
Right, everyone's happy, right? So the big study came out and we talked about how they've increased from my average 22, 23 patients a day to 27 patients a day in the same setting I'm in the primary care sports medicine standpoint. Increased productivity, but they also showed a second component, the secondary outcome was increased patient satisfaction. So, yes, everybody wins because the patients are happy, which is the most important piece of the puzzle. Physicians can get in and see more patients, which, you know, we always have a shortage of healthcare professionals in this country. And, most importantly, there is a role for an athletic trainer to come in there and bridge that gap.
Right.
And that's huge. I mean, that's a role that I think will become much more prominent in sports over the next 10 to 15 years.
Well, I can tell you that I think this is a really unique system that we set up, and I have total confidence in you as a physician. As I think back to a couple months, I called you when I was almost on my deathbed saying, can you please call in some antibiotics and an inhaler for me because I can't breathe, and you said, okay, I'll do this for you one time.
Yeah, that's it's kind of funny. He's throwing me under the bus there, but, you know, like I said, it's a very mutual respected relationship that we have, and, you know, it's about team, and if you're thinking about going to athletic training, the big thing you got to remember, you've got to be a team player no matter what.
It's about team, and it's about trust, and it's about relationship building, like Dr. Ott said.
Yeah, agreed. 100% agreed.
Well, if you want to learn more about Dr. Bajani, again, go to our website, www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT, and on the left-hand side, you're going to see a link called Partnerships. And under Partnerships, you're going to see Memorial Hermann Medical Group, you're going to see Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Rehab, Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute, and UT Department of Orthopedic Surgery. Dr. Bajani has been instrumental in developing these relationships for us, so much so that we were able to get some nice gifts for our students in the first week. And Dr. Bajani has been an incredible asset for us, and we are very fortunate to have him on board. I want to thank you very much for your time, sir. Again, I can't tell you how excited I am that you're on board.
Well, excitement's mutual. Can't wait to get this started.
And for the Master of Athletic Training Program, I'm Dr. Josh Ellen with Dr. Bajani. Thank you again.
You're welcome.